Mr. Edmund, please. Could you tell me how long you've been living in this house?
June, you're the one.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Edmund, for allowing me to come and talk to you. Could you just say for the tape your full name and your date of birth, please?
Yes, Edmunds. John Frederick. Born 26/4/20.
Thank you.
Do you want to...
And I believe you're commonly known as Jack.
Oh, yes, everywhere I've always stuck to the name Jack.
Now, I believe you had a very interesting working life, and it's a shame I haven't got time to ask you about all of it, but could we just zoom in on the part where you came to be involved in the island's tourist industry in the coach business?
Oh, yes,
can
indeed.
Can you tell me about how that began?
Yeah. There were two principal bus groups in England, the BET Group and the Thomas Tillings Group, both of whom applied for and got express licences into various parts of the country, of course, but in particular to Blackpool. They ran to Blackpool with 36 people per coach, who were accommodated by Brian Bradley of British United Airways on Dakota or DC-3 aeroplanes of 36 seats capacity. That was a nice arrangement of 36 passengers on a coach and 36 people on a plane. They then came to the Isle of Man on a half-hour flight and were picked up at the airport by Hamill's coaches at that time, that is those people who wanted to go to Douglas, of course. But at that point, any arrangements that the originating company had made for them was finished. There was a lacuna.
What year would this have been, do you think?
In 1961.
So there was a lacuna, yeah.
Oh, yes, yes. I devised the scheme of continuing the arrangements for those passengers on from Ronaldsway Airport by engaging for them, on behalf of the company from which they originated, the hotel accommodation, and of course where I used to make my profit was from coach tours, including transfers to and from the airport and taking them out on coach excursions. The big guarantee I offered to the originating companies in England was that they didn't have to actually pay for the holiday that they'd had on the Isle of Man until they had returned home. That was a sort of guarantee that I gave them. Then the thing to do was to sort out the hotels in which they were accommodated. The most successful of those hotels, of course, was run by Mrs. Harrison, Edna Harrison, who had the Doric Hotel on Queen's Promenade. She accommodated the people from Yorkshire Way, from South Down for a time, and from various companies in England, all of whom ran into Blackpool. From that small beginning, I went on to include even privately owned bus companies and bus companies belonging to the group, one or another of the two groups, from all over the UK, from Brighton in the south, that was South Down coaches, to Edinburgh in the that was Alexander's Northern. Actually, they were based in Aberdeen, however, and all points between. And they included, would you like me to detail the companies? Let me see now. I have to think of it. They amounted to some 1,600 people weekly for a six-month season. And it was very profitable, of course. The companies concerned were Alexander's Eastern from Edinburgh, A.T. Mays in Saltcoats, the Northern General Company in Newcastle, B-Line Tours of Hartlepool, Airways Travel of Newcastle, Hunting Gibson also of Newcastle, and the Northwestern Roadcar Company. Then there was the Yorkshire Way, the Yorkshire Traction Company, Heaps of Leeds, H-E-A-P, Trent Motor Traction Company, Potteries Motor Traction Company, Barton's Transport Limited, Granville Tours of Grimsby, South Down of Brighton, the East Kent Road Car Company from Chelmsford, Greenslades of Exeter, Salopia Saloon Coaches of Shrewsbury, and Red and White Motor Services from South Wales and Bristol.
Now these companies, they would be wanting to run tours to the Isle of Man, and they would get them as far as one side of the water and on the plain. And then can you explain how you would make your arrangements with them, how you go about contacting them, and what deal you do with them for how you took their passengers on further?
There was a principle involved. It involved a map of Great Britain showing all the principal towns and coloured flags. Wherever it was intended to address a company in one of those locations, then a flag was placed there. And there is, I have no recollection of ever being unsuccessful. We always managed to tap in to what was their ready-made market. This was an argument I put forward to Len Bond at the Tourist Board, a man for whom I have an abiding respect. The principle was that instead of what was the policy of the Tourist Board in those days,
in the early and mid 60s,
yes, to take a wet sponge dripping with water, throw it at the map of England, and if any drops happen to bear fruit, then so much the better. Whereas my principle was rather different. I pinpointed, I made a set at a chosen company and attracted them to send a party of 36 or 40 people to the Isle of Man, thereby tapping in to their own private market, because each of those companies produced their brochures showing the tours that they operated from time to time. The certain famous tours, Cornwall and Devon, Royal Deeside in Scotland, all that sort of thing. And I persuaded them, each of them, to include a week's holiday on the Isle of Man, thereby tapping into their clientele. which was reserved, of course, for them. They were, each of them, dealing with the kind of people who used to come every year to take their holidays with the same company, not necessarily to go to the same place, of course, to go to one or another different places, but dealing with the same company. And it was that captive clientele that I attempted to tap into, successfully, as it happened, fortunately.
And can you tell me, on the other side of the water, what the arrangements you were then making for an inclusive holiday with businesses on the Isle of Man, such as the hoteliers?
The thing, of course, I had to liaise with British United Airways and with the bus companies concerned to make sure that they had the appropriate licences to operate their express services. Then, having negotiated with the airways, the airlines concerned, I had to negotiate with the local hotels here, principally there was the Doric, that was the most important of them all. The Villiers was another hotel we used to use. The Hydro, the Excelsior, the Caledonia, the Metropole, the whole variety of other hotels, but mainly, not exclusively, but mainly on the Queen's Promenade, because in those days that turned out to be the better part of the promenade that we used. Now, the set program that they these people had was full board accommodation at the hotels, that is breakfast, lunch and dinner, with, wherever it was possible, entertainment in the hotel of an evening, if it happened to be inclement weather. Fairly simple entertainment, but nonetheless musical and playing games and that sort of thing. And the Doric Hotel were preeminent in that. The program was to do a half day tour to Peel, a full day tour around the island, a half day tour to Port Erin, and an evening mystery tour. Now, that meant, of course, with the fleet of coaches which I had built up in the meantime.
How many did you have by this point?
A total of 20 coaches at the the maximum. those people then went on their various trips, either half day or evening or full day, at my discretion, so that I had a fleet of coaches running round the Isle of Man, every one of them full, whereas my competitors were running about half empty, if in fact they managed to run at all, which was a different thing. However, I had to print letters to each individual announcing to them the days on which their tours would be taken, of course, to ensure that we operated to maximum capacity. From that beginning with inclusive tours, I went on to provide services for conferences coming to the Isle of Man, and in conjunction with the Isle of Man Tourist Board, I used to go across and visit intending conferences intending coming to the Isle of Man, and they included some fairly well-known names, the Shell Company, ICI, American Express, all those sort of people. that was a subject entirely on its own, actually, and had to be treated separately from the inclusive doors. It was for that purpose that I opened various travel shops in the Isle of Man, in Broadway, at the airport, and at Summerhill, and also at the Palace Arcade.
When did you open those travel shops?
Oh, they were opened around about 1964 onwards. They were open, and all registered with ABTA. And that, in turn, led to another enterprise, which was the provision of services for cruise liners, and of course the development of the cruise ships coming to the Isle of Man, the development of that sort of trade. It all sort of dovetailed into the use of coaches, and from the use of the coaches very economically, with a very good team of drivers, in fact the best that the island had to offer at that time, and very good coaches, which I bought eventually from Salopia Saloon Coaches. I took three of them at on one occasion, and that was the biggest purchase I ever had of three vehicles. But I frequently bought one vehicle or two vehicles each year. I borrowed more and more money. I borrowed money in the first place to start the business. I borrowed £1,000, which in those days was a hell of a lot of money. Then
that would have been in about 1961.
When I started it, yes, that's right. Then each year, the money was all ploughed back into the business, and each year I borrowed even more money, year by year by year. So it became a one-man business without any outside interest at all. It became very frightening, and I was glad to sell it because it tended to take me over rather than me running the business. The business ran me.
You mentioned that a lot of your competitors were running half-empty coaches, whereas yours were full. What were you doing that they weren't?
Inclusive tours. The answer to the whole thing was inclusive tours. The inclusive tours provided passengers for coaches at the discretion of the owner, and provided visitors for the boarding houses. Here it's essential to point out the difference between the scheme that I ran and the scheme that various other people, in particular the Sefton Hotel, are running. No disparagement intended. It's just although I did advise them in the early days to be very careful which hotels they used. You see, I was very careful to use only the very best of hotels, the hotels which offered the finest services, took the subject really seriously as an enterprise rather than simply as a money-making machine. In fact, I used to train my drivers insofar as they could make or break a person's holiday, and how would they like to have a coach driver or a waiter or a waitress ruin their holiday at the end of every summer.
Now, how did you feel the Manx hotel industry and guest house boarding houses, how did they respond to your initiatives?
They were very suspicious to start with, but after a time, they sort of begged me for business. But as I say, I had to be very, very careful to engage only those hotels who offered the best of accommodation services. Because I eventually had to answer to all these very big companies, very big and important companies throughout the length and breadth of England. I had to take responsibility for the hotels. The hotel owners, of course, would just sit on the Isle of Man and say, that's the way it is. Whereas I had to go to England and to face the music, so to speak, if there was anything wrong. From time to time, we did have complaints. And, of course, that was the end of that particular hotel.
How did the Manx hotels compare with the ones that you came into contact with when you were in England? You must have heard people talking in the business quite a lot about it.
Yes. The thing was that the accommodation that we offered on the Isle of Man was rather below standard, below the standard that was offered in England. Don't forget that we were dealing with privately owned hotels rather than big company hotels. However, there's no doubt about it that our standard of accommodation was below that offering in England. However, the hospitality and friendliness of the local people outweighed the dissatisfaction with the and of course one mustn't forget the quality of the food that was served in the hotels that we used. That was important.
You mentioned about also buying up Coach every year or two to expand the business gradually. How did you do that?
Where
did you get the coaches from?
Well, of course, If a survey was carried out for the tourist board, which showed that the single means of entertainment and the experience that the majority of visitors enjoyed the most on the island were the excursions that they made out from Douglas out into the countryside and to the smaller resorts around the island. But of course, there were so many coaches, as I recall it, over 100 in Douglas alone, all fighting for what was in those days diminishing traffic. And of course, a lot of those coach owners didn't succeed in travelling every day. And that they certainly never ever made enough money, made enough profit to renew their vehicles, so that we were faced with a fleet of vehicles running down year by year by year and never being replaced or remodeled. So consequently, a lot of owners were only too pleased to be able to sell their businesses and their vehicles for a reasonable sort of price and to get out from a declining business. And that was the case with Tours Isle of Man. We bought various owners who wanted to get out of the business, and they included a Ranson of Happy Ways, Neville Clegg of Broadway Coaches, Marjorie Farragher at Peel. They're the only ones I can think of at the moment. Oh, sorry, Scots, of whom the son had decided his interest was more in boats than in coaches, and Creagh Collister, who was the local agent for Cook's Tours, and he just wanted to retire from the business altogether.
again about the hotels in particular. When you were did you yourself have to negotiate things like prices with the hoteliers, or was that done by the companies who were subcontracting to you from England?
No. I contracted with all the hotels in my own name and on my own responsibility. I had to lay down that, of course, that's why I chose the hotels who I could trust. There was certain things like cups of tea or coffee, things that seem very simple. Cups of tea or coffee after lunch or dinner. Some hotels tried to charge sixpence a cup for tea or coffee. Well, of course, I just couldn't allow that sort of thing. And I adopted a principle where whatever the people had at the hotel was part of the cost, even if it was added on to start with. That was that led to a principle on tipping, because the hotels all raised this subject with me during my negotiations, and I evolved a principle of tipping, which is as follows: that tipping presupposes a particularly high standard of service. You tip in advance of, or agree to tip in advance of receiving a standard of service which may or may not be forthcoming in the event. And to me it seemed grossly unfair, whereas if it were left entirely to the discretion of the people concerned, if they were made aware that tips were not included in their tariff, then there was an incentive for them to tip as they should tip for an exceptionally good standard of service or information or food or whatever. However, the basic provision of information or food or service was of course paid for in wages, but the provision of a particularly good service was not paid for and was entitled to be tipped.
Were there any bones of contention that would appear year after year between you and the hoteliers, things that you could never completely see eye to eye on?
Tipping, I think, was the only subject that we never came to agreement. However, I adopted an intransigent attitude, and it had to be that way or not at all. It was very rare that it was necessary to boil things down to that extent of saying that's the way it is.
Do you think the hoteliers were keen on the coach parties as a way of doing business in a new way, or were they keen on the coach party because their traditional custom was falling away?
It was because their traditional custom was falling away that they welcomed. There was a superfluity, of course, of hotel accommodation, and rooms were left empty, particularly in the shoulders of the season, whereas my inclusive tours used to start in a small way at the end of April, for example. Then during May they steadily climbed up until they reached a peak of the last 2 weeks of May. Then of course we were into the main season. Similarly at the back end, September was a very busy month, and even into a couple of weeks of October we had the remains of traffic operating. But generally speaking, hoteliers welcomed the idea of having all arriving at once, all the visitors arriving at once, that was an inconvenience, but it was accepted with good grace, because it was either accept them as they come in parties of 36 or not at all. So you can please yourself, whichever you have.
Now, did you pay the hoteliers in advance for the rooms?
No. That was paid in arrear. It was paid 1 week in arrear.
How many hotel rooms were you booking at the height of the season, at the height of your success?
Hundreds. I couldn't even make a guess. I couldn't even make a guess. Whole hotels were given over entirely to... the argument that I offered to hotels was that